What I do want to present is two ideas around how to future-proof, and then I'm going to unpack these as we go through the next hour. The first one is the idea of if you're going to future-proof your institution, you have to get the level of urgency at a level that makes people want to do things differently, but doesn't scare them out of their wits so that they get paralyzed, right? So there's this urgency that has to happen. And then I want to talk with you a little bit about a dual mindset for change. And it's what a lot of universities are struggling with right now as to which mind to be in around change. I should give just a really brief, I've spent 25 years in my career in administration. My last gig was the Vice President for Student Life at Baylor, SICM. And then I spent 15 years at Azusa Pacific as a faculty member in the doctoral program in higher education. My research and my research grants were around change and innovation in higher education. And oftentimes people would say innovation in higher education is oxymoron. And I actually had to stop using the word innovation because it's a dirty word for faculty. So I talk a lot about adaptive change when I'm talking to the academy, but it is what it is. It is innovation. And so we're struggling with how to do it. And so what I want to talk to you a little bit about, too, is university structures and how we think about setting our organizations up for change. I mean, here is the reality, folks, that a culture natural state is status quo. So we complain a lot about higher education and how it moves and those kind of things, but you know, my brother owns us a few small businesses, and we were talking about this presentation. We got to this slide and he said, it's not just higher education. He said, once something is set in my organization, it becomes law, you know, and then it's really hard for us to change. And they're a digital media firm, so they're changing all the time. But they said, it is just interesting that cultures try to maintain a status quo, because that's what a culture is to try to get the values aligned and those kind of things. And bureaucracies in particular crave predictability. They crave stability and control. That's the nature of a bureaucracy, right? That's why we have layers of organizations and those kind of things, so we can have it. So our very organizations don't really set us up. So we can talk about innovation till we're blue in the face, but we have to understand that it is within the organization and it is within the way we are structured that actually makes it more difficult for us to move in that direction. For those of you who came yesterday, you heard me talk about these four major, what I call shifting plates in America. I'm not going to go over those again because I don't want to bore you guys about it. But I will say that every single one of these has a direct impact. And if you weren't at it yesterday, and you want me to send you those slides, they're pretty self-explanatory and I can do that. But it kind of lays out the case for, you know, wealth distribution. And it's not so much the wealth distribution, it is the fact that our campuses have grown and thrived on the middle class. The middle class is changing dramatically. And it's the cost of education is going up, but the cost of education has always gone up. It's not that education is going up, it's that middle class wages aren't going up, and it is the jobs that kids are getting when they leave have not gone up. So as you raise higher education costs and you don't raise their earning potentials, that's when you get the critical message. And that's what's hitting us. And a lot of people feel like it's all higher education's fault. And I say, we are just a tip of the iceberg of the problem that's happening that's creating these kind of issues for us. But the big one I like to talk about now, because I don't think that in institutions like ours that we're really got our heads around, and that is the declining birth rate. So anytime you have a recession or an economic equilibrium, the birth rate declines. And it usually in 5 years, then it will correct and come back. What we found is it declined. It's not correcting. So we're finding that our millennials are not having children. Now, a lot of people begin to believe that in their late 30s that they will, and they are beginning to do that in the late 30s, but not at the levels that we need it to be to overcompensate for the lower decline that happened in 06 through 08, right? So that bubble and that decline is coming at us in 2023, 24, 25, 26, okay? And it's going to be a pretty significant decline. It's primarily in white middle class, okay? We won't find the same decline in Hispanics. In fact, we will find slight Hispanic growth as it goes forward. It will not decline in the Asian populations. The big decline is going to be in white middle class, primarily Northeast and Lakes region, okay? But we're going to find it all over the country. But if you're sitting in Texas, and in some ways you get a boost in Oklahoma for that, this will not hit you the same way because their high school, their rate of going to high school and their rate of graduation is set. Everybody else, it's a different day. It's a new day. And if you think you're sitting in Oklahoma, you think you'll go to Texas, everybody's going to Texas right now. Everybody is changing their strategies to move into Texas. So it's, even though they may have higher graduation rates, this problem is national, and so it will disperse through all states. But again, I won't go through all of these again, but what you do find on college campuses is, I don't know about you, but if you sit in many of these presentations, I just want to run out of the room and stick my head in some sand and say, you know what, I'm just going to teach my class, leave me alone, okay? I mean, it's overwhelming, all of the different kind of things. And it is to the point where we feel like, wow, it's too big and it's too much. And where do we even begin to think about it? But the fact of the matter is, if we wait until 2024 to start dealing with the declining birth rate, it's too late. We're out of business. Okay? It just is that. These are the issues that we have to deal with now so that we set future generations up. I know for me sometimes I think, well, 2026, hopefully I'll be retired by then. It's no one else's problem. But you want to try not to have that kind of idea, because what you do now will set them up for success or failure. The one I didn't cover yesterday that I did want to cover just briefly today is really around this idea of technology, because I think its sense of urgency is right in front of us. Now, I know for many of you, you're thinking, what is this picture of? Okay, and I just want to let you know, if you're thinking that, I hate you. But it is, I was at an antique show the other day, and they had a card catalog, and I'm like, oh, you know, the things I grew up with are now at the antique show. So that's sobering, isn't it? Sobering. Anyway, but if you think about it, if you think, what were you doing just 10 or 15 years ago? Really, not that long ago in a lifespan. You know, you weren't listening to music on an iPod, you know. You had a big boombox that you were carrying around, right? And you only had 8 songs, or you had an 8-track cassette, or those types of things. You weren't Googling anything. Can you imagine a world without Google now? I mean, like, you actually had to call restaurants to find out when they were open. You actually had to look things up in what we probably don't, some of you don't know, is an encyclopedia, okay, which is actually out of date the minute it was printed, right? And so we had to do those kind of things. We couldn't ask those bizarre questions, you know, like, why do they call this Orlando? I'll Google it, Orlando. You know, I mean, all the kind of things that we do now on Google, I mean, I don't know how many times I Google something every single day. Just 10 years ago, we did not have that access to any of that information. We weren't texting someone. Those were the beautiful days of teaching, because you weren't trying to fight with the attention of a student's texting. But we weren't reading our email or taking a picture on our cell phones. Really, the iPhone came out in 07. The distribution really came critical mass in 10. And so we oftentimes call 2010 the inflection point, because that's when so many of these things tried to change. We weren't finding directions through our GPS. Can you imagine? I mean, people were always saying, oh, the GPS is dangerous. You know, it doesn't tell you till the last minute. I said, no. Pulling your map out of your glove compartment and unwrapping it while you're driving down the street, that's dangerous, okay? The GPS, they're not dangerous. I went to AAA the other day getting ready for a trip, and I asked him for a map, and he started laughing. He's like, you're the first person this week that's asked for a map. I'm like, what are you actually going to do with it? I'm like, I'm actually reading the map. I'm like, I actually want to see where I'm going. And he was about 22, and I thought I would slap him. Anyway, we also aren't asking Siri and Alexa questions like, do you love me? Right? You know, if you haven't done that, it's fascinating. And it will make you feel better about your life when you ask. So you should do it. But we weren't doing any of that. Can you imagine? I mean, 10 years ago, I walk into my office and I would have a pile of pink slips of people that I have to call back, right? Like, who has pink slips anymore? I mean, nobody calls you. When I was at Baylor, I was high tech because I had an electric typewriter on my desk and it had an automatic correction ribbon, right? So you could push a button and correct. Some of you are shaking your head. You didn't have to get out that white stuff and mess up everything. You could just correct. That was high tech. The phone was down the hall. You know, if you would have told me when I was in Baylor that we were going to have phones in our cars, I would have thought, now how are they going to manage all those wires? You know, I would have had no idea of how to even conceptualize a phone in my car and how to think about it. And I'm old, but I'm not that old, right? I mean, this is all within our lifetime, the sphere of influence of technology. I always laugh, there's a picture at the Vatican before 2010, and this is a picture after it, you know? I mean, just the ubiquitousness of pictures and videos and all of those kind of things has changed the landscape, if you think about it. And then you even think about the internet and the waves that it's gone through in our lifetime, right? And so we think about the web, and when it started, this is Southwest Airlines. Oh my gosh, if you pulled up a website like that, you wouldn't stay on it now, right? I mean, we went into this really recreating the web into something, but what really changed the web? Oh, and this was Amazon. It was when Amazon only sold books, right? I mean, can we even remember when they actually just sold books? You know, now you can kind of get your firstborn male child delivered to you, you know. And if you're Prime, you can get it tomorrow. So, you know, I mean, it's crazy what you can get on Amazon now and the domination of Amazon across the world. But what really changed the web was search engines. You know, it made everything accessible to us in really interesting ways. Then we got into social media, right? And now it's so funny because I won't go to a restaurant unless it has 4 stars. I won't read a book unless it's, you know, highly reviewed. Whereas just 10 years ago, I read a book because I wanted to read the book. Now it's like, no, social media and that ability to get other people's opinion. And certainly now in the age of Twitter and the way the president is able to influence policy and people with Twitter, who would have ever thought that, you know, 10 years ago that 140 statements, or I guess it's larger now, but those that kind of wordage would have the impact on the country that it has. And then obviously now, it's the personalization, and it's the amount of data that is collected on us every single day. Your phone has 7 different sensors that are collecting data on you. Everywhere you drive is collected. Everything you order on Amazon is collected. Every data point on your Fitbit is collected. All of that now is accessible. And I think about how it changes our college students today. You know, 18 to 25-year-olds reach for the device every 7 minutes, right? And so every 7 minutes we're picking up. And it really impacts us in some really stunning ways, especially around our attention span, right? But I would say it's not just our college students, it's us as well. I mean, I was reading a study on how many of us will read our cell phones in the first 15 minutes of being awake, right? And how reading it changes the whole outlook for your day and some of those kind of things. And so we all have to be very careful of the addiction to technology that's happening right now, but it so shapes even the way we think. You know, and it really began with big data and our ability to collect data. I mean, I kind of think about Target. I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but Target has an app, right? And you can download the app, and then when you go into Target, it will turn on, and it allows you to see where the sales are, and you get special deals and those kind of things. Target actually has taken all that data, and they've been able to analyze, if you're pregnant, what you search for. And so they know that if you walk into the store and you're pregnant, they will feed to your phone the things that pregnant people need, right? Sometimes they know a woman is pregnant before her family knows that she's pregnant, right? I mean, so it's this kind of crazy world of tracking that's going on. And so you find these increased means of capturing the data, but it's also had to have a way to have it stored. And so that the movement toward the cloud and the ability to gain large sums of data has made a big difference. But probably the game changer is really the artificial intelligence, because you can have all that data, but how do you make sense of it? You know, how do you begin to really think it and use it? And that's what artificial intelligence has done for us. It's the algorithms that run our life are these ubiquitous things that we don't know that are happening all the time. But there's what's sorting information to us, thinking all the time. And this ability for computers now to take our data and to learn from it and predict in different ways. It's really the next generation of robotics, those kind of activities. And so, you know, all the things from, you know, self-driving cars all come from this heart of the data that's been collected, the algorithms that have been written, and the way that they're able to move that into robotics. And we think, oh, well, that's kind of interesting and all those kind of things. But all of these movements are very transformative for us as a culture. I mean, really, the fact that we may not in 10 years be driving cars anymore is a pretty transformative piece to what we do. 90% of the world's data has been generated over the last 2 years, right? And that was in 13. So I would guess that it's more like 98% of the world's data has been collected over the last 5 years. So it really, you begin to understand the decades and decades that happened before us, they collected a very small amount of data, and that's how this has changed. Kind of an example of this is this VP at Ford said this, and then he tried to backtrack, but it was already on social media. He said, "We know everyone who breaks the law. We know when you're doing it. We have GPS in your car, so we know what you're doing." Right? And if you've ever really looked into like a missing person and how they can track missing people, I mean, it's kind of crazy. Your car, your phone, your Fitbit, all these different kind of things keep your whereabouts. So if you want to run away from home, you're really going to have to get off the grid. So, but I think even the grid is beginning to track us. So we'll see from there. But it's beginning to reshape us. That's the past, but it's reshaping us right now, isn't it? If you think about, you know, Amazon, it kind of drives me crazy in some ways. You get on, you order a few things. The next time you get on, you get all these recommendations for things that you want to order. And they're things like, oh, yeah, I do want to order that. How did they know that kind of thing? I laughed a couple Christmases ago. I ordered a bunch of things for my nephews at Christmas, Transformers and all that kind of guy stuff. And then for the next month, I got recommendations on Transformers. I'm like, no, yeah, you kind of missed out on that. But what Amazon's working on right now is really ways to ship things to us before we actually even order them. So if you go through a bottle of Tide every 2 months, they will ship you a bottle of Tide, even if you don't request it, right? And so they're going to really be able to predict our behaviors in ways that sends out things before we know it. Google, I mean, the amount of information they have on each one of us kind of boggles your mind. But even in banking, when I travel internationally, if I don't remember to call my credit card in my bank, right, my credit card gets shut off. And so my credit card knows where I am and my natural patterns of travel, and they know exactly when I cross over that, those types of things. And so, even the card in your wallet or your purse is tracking you in some interesting ways. But I also want to say, though, that this technology gives us some really new, interesting breakthroughs that I think are going to be important. And so I don't want to make it seem like it's Big Brother in all sorts of ways and it's all a negative. I happen to have a kind of cancer. It's a good kind of cancer. But if it returns, they can biopsy a tumor and they can tell me within a 98% accuracy how long I have to live within 2 years, right? Now, for me, I'm a planner. I'm like, yeah, I want that data because I want to die with a dollar. Okay, so I want to come out even. So let me know kind of how that's going to go. But it's transforming, absolutely transforming medicine. But you look at a place like Arizona State, right? And they've really bought into this idea of adaptive learning. So what they found several years ago was that they had a very high dropout rate based on whether you pass college algebra or not. If you pass college algebra the first time around, your chances of graduating from the university were greatly improved. If you failed it the first time around, even if you took it another time and passed it, but you failed it the first time around, your chances of graduating from the university were greatly diminished, okay? So they said college algebra is a gateway for us that we have got to work on. So they started working with Pearson on a thing called Newton. Newton is a computer program that students go through the college algebra class on. But what makes it fascinating is that you're a student and you're working on a problem in algebra, right? Newton analyzes that and they give you feedback and they say, listen, it was just the arithmetic. You've got to take more time and focus on 2 plus 2. Or no, it was the logic in this part of the question that you really didn't understand. This is where you got it wrong. And they send you videos that show you how your logic needs to change to this logic, right? So instead of just getting this mark back from the faculty wrong, and you can't really figure out what you did that was wrong, it diagnoses it all, and it tracks all the students all the way through, and it's giving the professor all sorts of data on where they're getting hooked and what they're getting stuck on so they can provide additional tutoring and those types of things. They have found in 1 year, right, without even building the support structures around it, they found their pass rate increased 17%. And now they're far enough out that they're able to project that it's also improved their retention, something between 12 and 15%, which quite frankly for us financially is a game changer on our universities if we can improve retention like that. Their withdrawal from the class was cut in half. And their completion, so students can work at their own time through this course, which I think is brilliant because some of our students, you know, they can finish college algebra in 5 weeks, but we keep them in there 15 weeks, and then they're bored stiff, and that creates something in your class that you don't want. But instead, these students that they've taken college algebra, they know how to do it, they can finish it in 5 weeks, they're done, check it off, they can go focus on another class or something like that. So there's a lot of things to it, and it's kind of set up, you know, it gives students constant feedback all the time, so it feels a little like a gaming environment so that they get this, those types of things. I think that's how we can use technology really effectively. A place like Civitas Learning out of Austin is a big data firm, and they write programs that go in at your university and capture all of your information. So they know everything from where you live in the residence halls and if you had a roommate disagreement and had a change to what you made in math in eighth grade, right? Because your transcripts are submitted. They take all of that data, pull it together, and do a lot of predictive analysis on it. So they find one university I was working with, they went in and they said, what's the problem that you really want us to focus on? And they said, we have low retention rates of our Hispanic men. Well, they did the numbers, they crunched the numbers, and they came back, and they said, no, you have low retention rate of Hispanic men from 5 zip codes that take this course in their first semester and don't pass, right? So when you have that kind of data, you can actually create interventions that make a difference. You know, what we're doing right now is we get out a shotgun and just, you know, just try everything, right? And what they also do is they say, try these 5 interventions, and then they'll come back to you in 3 years, and they'll say, these 2 aren't working, don't do them anymore. These 2 are making the difference for you. This one might marginally make a difference. So then you can actually do smart interventions as opposed to just, you know, we sat around a table and came up with an idea, and that was a good thing. Now, the problem for us with Civitas and big data is that our schools don't oftentimes have a large enough sample for us to make too many predictive analytics. But this is what I keep saying is this is where consortiums of private schools have got to get smarter, right? We all think our kids are so different. Hey, guess what? They're not, okay? There are a lot of things. We could pull our numbers together and look, you know, at the trends that we're all seeing across the Wesleyan schools. You know, do we have the same problem with college algebra? Do we have the same problem, you know, with Hispanic men? We couldn't say the zip codes, but there are a lot of things that we could really answer about our students at Wesleyan colleges if we would pull that together and get large enough data. But what the data does, I think, is it blows up preconceptions that are wrong that we are building our systems off of. So this is what Civitas found after they've been working with about 150 different universities. So we all think that our low GPA students are where we're going to focus. So a tremendous amount of our money and time is spent on remediation, right? Look at this. 4-year institutions, these are the GPAs of students that left, right? Under 2.0, 36%, over 3.0, 42%, right? So it's really actually our higher achieving students that are leaving the institution at higher rates. And look at this, at selective institutions, it's 40%. Now, don't get me wrong, at selective institutions, they're only losing maybe 10 students a year. They don't lose a lot. But when they do lose a lot, it is not necessarily the kids that just can't make it at the selective institutions. Something else is going on. You know, we had this big, I was in charge of retention when I was at Baylor, which was unfortunate because my niece came and she transferred to go to A&M where her boyfriend was, and my nephew came and he had a .02 GPA. So he got booted, and on the committee we got the list of all the kids that had left, and people would say, well, if your family would stop coming, we could improve our retention, you know, like overnight, right? So I'm like, yeah, thanks. But I was in charge of it, and we had a dip one year, and everybody got frantic, and, you know, we're going to call Noel Levitz, and we're going to spend a lot of money and all that kind of stuff. And I said, just give me the data. Give me as much data as you can give me. And they gave me this data. You know where we had lost the most amount of kids? The Honors College. So I went over to the Honors College, and I'm like, what the heck's going on? And it was kind of a little bit of an anomaly. And they're like, the head of the Honors Department had sabbatical last year. Right, and so he wasn't around at all, and he was such a force to keep kids connected and those kind of things. And I said, Alton Smith cannot go on sabbatical ever again, right, unless he wants to give us $1 million for all the kids we lost. But that's what data can do for you, right? It can get us to stop making these knee-jerk reactions, and it can help us make better decisions. So as a board, you know, really encouraging your universities in terms of what data are we collecting and what could we collect and how can we get smarter with all that happens. But this is the reality, and I know these quotes, these stats have been talked about a couple of different times at the conference, but if you look at it, a recent study examined the probability of computerization for 702 occupations, found that 47% of workers in America had the potential for jobs, high risk for potential of jobs being automated. 73% of work that which humans are now paid is spent in activities that could be automated with existing technology. So the technology already exists. Now, we don't have the capital, we don't have all sorts of resources to make that technology work for the businesses and organizations, but it already exists, and so eventually we will find ways to make that happen. And then we say futurists estimate that up to 80% of the jobs up to 85% of jobs that will exist in 2030 haven't been invented yet. Okay? So the reality of what I keep trying to say on our campus is we are preparing students for a world that we cannot imagine. Right? We can't even really conceptualize the world that we're going to be preparing them for. But the one thing we can conceptualize is that it will be different than the world we have right now. It'll be dramatically different because technology, the pace of technology continues to change. And so if what we're preparing them for is going to be really, really different, then how we prepare them and how we think about it has to be really, really different. I was talking to our faculty the other day about some of these kind of things, and they said, well, then what should we be about? You know, if accounting's going away and computers are going to program themselves and all those kind of things. And I said, I'll give you three things that we all need to be about. One of them is curiosity, right? Because their ability to ask questions in an ambiguous world is going to be critical, right? If you've ever taught a class and you had curious students in your class, it makes a huge deal of difference, doesn't it? The questions they're asking. But if you employ a lot of people and you employ someone who's asking great questions and helping you to rethink your assumptions, they're golden, right? And that's what they're going to need, is an ability to be curious and explore and not be afraid of ambiguity, because their world is going to be ambiguous and they can't be afraid of it. Second one is creativity. And I don't mean the arts or singing or those kind of things. I mean the ability to have the courage to try something new and to help students to do that. And then the third is compassion. And I don't mean a soft kind of compassion. I mean a compassion that is able to hear other people's perspectives and keep those in mind, not necessarily adopt their perspectives, but to hear them and to listen. And I think in our divided world, we need compassionate people that will listen. But you know what's fascinating about it? I taught a freshman seminar a few years ago, and I was really focused on how do I increase capacity, curiosity in them. How do we do this? We had just done a big dissertation study on faculty that increase curiosity in their students. And one of the things they did was to give them some autonomy in some of the assignments that you're giving them, right? So I had a wild card assignment that they could, as long as it stayed within the discipline of what we were trying to learn and fit with the coursework, they could do pretty much anything they wanted to show an interest in a learning, right? You would have thought I asked them to cut off their arm. I mean, they were like, what do you want? I mean, how will we be graded? Like, can you show us from last year who made an A? You know, and it was always about, can you tell me how to get an A? And I kept saying, don't worry about the A. Build your curiosity. Go find something. Seek after it. Oh my gosh, they weren't listening to that. You know, they were like, okay, give us a rubric. Tell us exactly. Show us some examples. Well, I know from the research that if I show them examples, sure enough, 80% of them do exactly like the examples, you know, that I showed them. And they did. So it is, we have to reteach. I mean, it's not an easy process to teach curiosity because they have been trained to learn for the test, right? They've been trained to come up with one right answer. And that will not serve them well in this world that we can't imagine, right? They're going to have to be trained. But irrelevance, and this is a big threat, I think, in some of our schools, it happens when the speed of change outside an organization is greater than the speed of change within the organization. And this has been the real disconnect for us in the last 10 or 15 years in higher education, hasn't it? Is that we just haven't been able to keep up with the speed of change. And we're kind of coming into it, we're kind of realizing it, but it is still hard not to stick your head in the sand, isn't it? It's still hard to figure out. So what I want to talk to you about today is really these two ideas about, I mean, I've talked about urgency, and I would say that, you know, one of the big values that a board can bring is keeping the pedal on the urgency, you know, asking us every time we meet, what are we doing? How is this moving? What are we experimenting in? How are we rethinking? And then, quite frankly, folks, to ask us why. Why we're doing it. Because when I was on the board for 3 years at Warner Pacific before I went on staff there, and what I found is that a lot of regents were a little scared to ask the questions or a little scared to challenge some of the assumptions because they thought, well, we don't know higher ed. You know, this isn't our business, so, you know, we can't challenge it. And I want to say, thank goodness you don't know higher ed, right? Because then you can ask us questions that we can't see anymore. So then the second piece of this is to really approach change with a dual mindset. And as I've traveled the country, I've realized that campuses really do take either one position or another position, and rarely both. But one of them is transformation A, and this comes by from Dual Transformation, a brand new book that came out last year. And they talk about the transformation is around repositioning an institution to maximize its existing, right? So these are the kind of things that we take and we say, you know, how can we do liberal arts better? How can we do this? We're trying to take our institution and improve it. We're trying to add new majors. We're trying to think differently about the majors that we have, all sorts of things. Transformation B is really creating a new growth engine, right? It's really creating something that focuses completely on innovation, something the institution hasn't done before. It's trying to break new ground, those types of things. And so what you see in the 80s and 90s, this was really exemplified by online universities. A lot of universities created online universities that are kind of freestanding entities. So like at APU, 6 years ago, they created their online, it was APU Online. Now it is spun off and it's LAPU, Los Angeles Pacific University. It's own brand. It always says it's a subsidiary. But basically, we're treating APU like a system now, and that system has several new schools. LAPU is one of our system schools, right? And the reason that they decided to do that and decided to move in that direction was the speed at which the institution could move was too slow to make our online university competitive, right? And the arguments that we were having, you know, over whether online is legitimate, the online university said, we're over that. right? And so spending a year to pass something doesn't make you, in the online space, a player. So they decided to spin off and are doing it separately. And that's what a lot of universities are doing, you know, is trying to figure out how to have entities that don't need to run through the slower academic process, okay? That comes with some challenges, doesn't it, right? Like the question of branding, the question of closeness to mission, the question, you know. So APOU used to get a lot of Christians, you know, when we started, the faculty were like, how could you do faith integration, you know, as well online? Faith integration is a person-to-person thing. A new study they just did last year found that their faith integration scores were higher online than they were face-to-face. And the reason being is because everybody that comes into LAPU gets a coach, a success coach. And those coaches meet with them every week, and the coaches pray with them and talk through them and those kind of things. And so you can do faith integration. You have to set online up in a way that does that. So anyway, what I'd like for us to do is just maybe break into groups of four or five around the room. And I'd like for you to talk in terms of regents, because I do think that you have some ability to speak into structure, right? Do you feel like that really transformation B, just spinning off and creating something new, is maybe the way you have to think about it, or you have historically thought about it, want to keep thinking about it? So I know IWU kind of did this. They did an interesting thing, right? They have an online, but all the online courses still have to be approved by the traditional faculty. And so it slows them down in some pretty significant ways because of that. Or is transformation A, should we really be focused on what we do now, what we do well, and making it more relevant, move faster, those kind of things, okay? So let's just spend a few minutes. Now, most of you are going to say we should do both, but pick a camp and go with that camp for a few minutes, okay? Pick A or B and go for that. All right, so if we just do four, I'm only going to give you a few minutes, so make sure everybody has a chance to weigh in. I want to show you this video, and then I'll make a
bike riding a bike, meaning it's really easy and you can't forget how to do it, right? But I did something. I did something that damaged my mind. It happened on the streets of Amsterdam. And honestly, I can't ride a bike like you can anymore. Before I show you the video of what happened, I need to tell you the backstory. Like many six-year-olds with a MacGyver mullet, I learned how to ride a bike when I was really young. I had learned a life skill, and I was really proud of it. Everything changed, though, when my friend Barney called me 20...
Five years later.
Where I work, the welders are geniuses, and they like to play jokes on the engineers. He had a challenge for me. He had built a special bicycle, and he wanted me to try to ride it. He had only changed one thing. When you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. When you turn it... ...play jokes on the engineers. He had a challenge for me. He had built a special bicycle, and he wanted me to try to ride it. He had only changed one thing. When you turn the handlebar to the left, the wheel goes to the right. When you turn it...
You know, you gotta love technology, don't you? Okay, I don't want to spend too much of our time waiting for it to buffer, so I'm going to explain it to you, and then we go on. These slides are available. I'll give my email address at the end if you want to get them from me. The link to this video is you can watch. But basically, the piece of it is that when you change the bike like this, it becomes very, very difficult to ride. It took him 8 months to try to make that change in riding it every single day to where he could actually keep the bike going and not have his cell phone distract him and those types of things. And then he took the bike to Amsterdam. Well, he took it around to the country and did it all sorts of different presentations that he was doing to try to show that that no one can do it, that it's very, very difficult the first time you get on to change your mind and to actually change your mind on something. And then he took it over to Amsterdam, and he then tried to ride a normal bike again, and he couldn't ride that normal bike again because he had rewired his mind to go in a particular direction. Now, in a few minutes, he was able to click back into that way of riding a bike, but it just goes to show you that oftentimes, you know, we think to why are our campuses resisting change? Why are our, you know, faculty not more on board with what we're doing? Those kind of things. And sometimes it is the will, but other times it is actually how difficult it is to think differently. You know, I had another faculty and I were put in charge of creating an EDD program, and the one charge that we went by was it needs to be different than anything else anybody is doing. I mean, you get a chance just to blow it up. You don't have to necessarily do dissertations. You could just, you know, do it from beginning. And we laughed because after we got through doing it, I said, this looks painfully like everyone else's EDD program, right? I mean, it was much more difficult to get out of our way. What you find happens on our campuses is that we oftentimes will say to ourselves, well, we can't change that because it's sacred. Or we're going to be on a slippery slope. We're going to be moving away from our Christian. You know, we said that when online came on, right? I remember those conversations like, you can't do faith integration online. You know, it's going to take away from the personal piece of it. So we really, well, it really started with adult education way back in the 70s. You know, we said that about adult. So many of the faculty would say, listen, our business is 18 to 24-year-olds. You know, we don't have any business with adults, okay? Then we don't have any business being online. Those types of things, because it's just really hard to conceptualize the fact that other modalities could do what we do with the same type of vigor, the same type of faith integration, the same type of individual connection. And then we have this whole idea of it's not broken, we don't need to fix it, and so let's just keep going. You know, the students, and as faculty, we oftentimes think students really like my class, right? They really love my class. So what if they're only half of them that used to be in there, right? The four that are still signing up really like the class, and so I must be doing it right. And so we have this kind of mentality, and we often argue from a place of our preference, but I used to work at George Fox and Quaker Institution, and Quakers will always ask themselves, are you arguing out of preference or conviction? And I think that's what institutions need to get more clear about. Like, what are our essential values that we won't change, and every new innovation needs to come through those values. But then after those values go, then we ought to be able to say, we can change it. Right? If it doesn't conflict with our values, then we can change it. But it's really hard to see them. And what's really difficult is it's hard for us to even see our long-held assumptions. They just really become embedded. But if you're going to future-proof your organization, you have got to get really good at asking the questions that really bring up the assumptions to the surface so that you can look at them and begin to make some changes. So one of our assumptions is, you know, the liberal arts are core to our courses. And I'm an English major. I bleed liberal arts. But there's this idea oftentimes on campuses that liberal arts and the professional programs really aren't compatible, right? They don't, you know, professionals are about teaching, you know, especially liberal arts have a special disdain, at least on our campus, for the business school, right? The business school is all about money. It's all about, you know, technical. It's all about this kind of stuff. Liberal arts, we're the true essence of the university. We teach people how to be good human beings and all those kind of things. And we seem to think that these two things are kind of incompatible, and we set our curriculum up that way, right? We have general ed classes, and then we have major classes, and they very rarely meet. They're very rarely, and because they don't meet, it makes the enterprise more expensive. Incoming students should primarily take their general ed requirements the first 2 years. You know, this makes me crazy because at 18, they are less likely to get liberal arts than they are at 21. You know, it takes you some life experience, doesn't it? It takes you being in some classes and those kind of things before you can really understand ethical dilemmas at their heart and those types of things. But what do? We load them up with these classes the first 2 years, okay? And for a lot of students, if you ask them on your campus, what do you think about the GE? most of them, if they're being honest with you, will say it's basically a checklist of things I have to check off before I can get to my major class. Okay? You feel a lot of that. They don't know why they're taking it. They have no idea how it relates. They just think it's this perfunctory thing that they have to go through because it keeps faculty employed or whatever they think, but they don't think about it because we never spend any time translating and helping them to understand what the liberal arts do, and then we teach them way too young. And it's best taught by a 3-unit course with one faculty that has a great deal of expertise around it, okay? So we wouldn't necessarily say these are assumptions, but they are because they guide our behaviors, okay? This is how we set it up, and if you start trying to think differently about it, you kind of get this heretical piece. So we're rewriting our digital media marketing program. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to say enough of that divide. They've got to inform each other for it to be coherent. So in the first semester, we have Introduction to Digital Media, and we have Ethics of Technology, because they need to begin to ask themselves, what is truth in the online environment, okay? If you get online and you tweet something and 200,000 people read it, then it becomes truth, right? It becomes part of the American way of thinking about things. Well, that's not accurate. That's not it. But if you don't give them an ethical framework to think through what is truth and how they'll know it, at the same time, you're exposing them to all sorts of different digital media outlets. And so the two courses come together and they can be team taught by faculty who can bring it to life so that ethics isn't something that they have to take that, you know, that they talk about. It never really shapes them. No, it's right there. You know, instead of taking just Introduction to Criminal Justice, they could take criminal justice and then they could take a history course on the justice in America and its relationship to the Christian faith. So what has been our influence on justice in America is the Christian faith, right? So instead of having a faith class, a history class, and a criminal justice class, you bring all three of them together, and then the students don't have to ask themselves, why am I studying history? They know why they're studying history, because it's informing what they're doing and how they're thinking. We desperately need more coherence in our liberal arts programs, no doubt about it. This is one that my friend who's a registrar wishes that I would take off, but I just can't because it makes me crazy. Okay, what's sacred at most of our universities is this 15-week semester where they're taking 4 to 6 classes during that kind of thing. It's kind of sacred, not online, but face-to-face. You know, it's kind of, this is the way we do it. And if you challenge it, you know, then people are like, oh, it'd be so messy and we'd have to redo all this and that kind of stuff. But what happens is it makes the curriculum limited, all right? So I have 50 to 75 minutes to teach my class. My class would be better taught if I'm teaching in sociology of poverty. It would be better taught at one of the churches in the poorest part of Portland, right? Where you are around and talking and feeling and understanding where there are homeless people lined up outside the church door. You know, that's the environment that you need to teach that type of sociology class in it. So they're looking and feeling. Because what happens right now is that higher education is disassociated from the real world. And we do internships. That's the way we connect it. But it needs to be deeply connected. Well, we can't do it with the 15-week. And on top of that, 15 weeks, you know, what they do is most students decide, these are my two hard classes, I'm going to spend most of my time on this, and these other 2 or 3 classes, I'm going to spend less time, even if I'm interested in them. They can't balance all 5, right? So why don't we do 8 weeks where we have 2 faculty members that are team teaching the kind of coherence that I was talking about, but then if one faculty member wants to take them for a day down to downtown Portland and do something there, or they want to take 2 days and actually travel to a swamp to study something, they can do it, because right now the schedule drives all the learning and it's very limited and it's not interesting and there's nothing new about it at its heart. I'm kind of passionate about this one, but I can get no registrar to buy into it, so and it would be difficult, and I'm not saying it's not complex, but we're smart people and we can figure out the complexity in some interesting ways as we go forward. And then the last one I'll talk about is faculty loads are one of those, you know, sacred cows. And a faculty load, you know, a lot of our faculty will say, I'm really, really busy because I'm teaching a 4-4 classes each semester, okay? Here's the reality of that, okay? Some of them really are busy because they've got 30 kids in their classes. They teach 4. They're teaching 120 students. That's a lot of papers to grade, right? That's a lot of office hours, a lot of interaction. But you have others that are teaching 10 students in a class, and they have 40 students total. That is a third of the class, a third of the workload that the other faculty have as they go through it. And we don't really make any accommodation. We don't say, oh, you only have 30 students, so why don't you pick up some of this administrative load, or why don't you do some of these kind of things, or we would really expect you to have some new classes that you're developing or something like that. We don't do that. And faculty, really, when they think they're teaching four classes, I think they know in their heart of hearts it's unfair when they have the small classes, but they still will say, I'm overworked because I'm teaching four. You know, my colleagues at the state institutions are teaching three, you know, so how in the world could I do any extra assignments? And it's because our classes are a third of the size than the other ones are. You know, we went through a time at Warner where we've had a dip in our enrollment. And what a dip in enrollment does is that for full-time faculty that keep their job, because mostly who we eliminate are adjuncts, it makes their classes much smaller, right? And I keep asking them, what are we getting out of your smaller classes? You know, what's the, you know, do you just have more time, more, you know, resources, or are we actually doing something like that? So it's a business model that has always been that way, but I'm suggesting that we need to look at it at net tuition revenue and really understand our budget from that particular question, not courses taught, but revenue produced. And not to say that everybody needs to teach large classes or everyone needs to do that. That's not what I'm suggesting. But I'm just suggesting we have to think differently about workload because we can't afford it the way it is right now. So anyway, we don't have time, unfortunately, to do this, but one of the things I hope you have some discussions on in your board and conversations at lunch is what are these deeply held assumptions that we say we can't change? You know, what are the things that we say, well, faculty will never go for that? No, faculty won't go for it, okay? But it doesn't mean it's not right for the university, and good faculty will come on board if you include them in it. So then we come to B, and this is the one where, you know, like I was talking about earlier, you know, we've had adult, we have online, and everybody's asking really what's next, because the competition in online has just gotten brutal, right? And, you know, like, I feel for anybody like Iwu. I mean, he did a wonderful job of jumping in early, getting on board, getting the first hit. There are no easy wins anymore. I mean, Iwu wasn't an easy win. They worked hard. They did really good work. But it was easier to get students then, right? I mean, because you're the only player in town. No one is the only player in town anymore. It's just not going to be that way. So everyone's kind of asking, okay, we're going to keep doing online, but what's next? It's not clear yet what's next. There's not a clear path yet. But that's why I think we have to stay really open to it, because what made Iwu work is that when they got the new idea, they didn't poo-poo it like they did at Grace. They embraced it. And they went for it. So we need to be thinking about this. Competency base is one of the areas, for those of you who might be familiar with Western Governors. Western Governors charges a student a flat rate for 6 months. Okay, they can take as many classes as they want during those 6 months. A lot of them are competency based. So as you go through the course, if you can pass the test and build the competency, you can move as fast as you can. So sometimes you can take a course in a month, 2 months, 3 months if you're not good in the topic, and you have a faculty mentor that walks with you through that. The fact of the matter is it works fairly well for Western Governors. It's not working quite as well at other small private liberal arts. Mary Harden Baylor is one to watch. They've jumped into competency base, but they're really struggling with enrollment to make those viable because they cost more to build as they go forward. This hybrid, you know, I've always said the reason Starbucks is so successful is that at the end of the day, we are community people. And even if you go sit at Starbucks and work by yourself, you're with other people and something changes for you. So online has allowed students to take courses and to get degrees. But at the end of the day, I think the next iteration is going to be some form of hybrid, but it's not going to be hybrid where you come to our campus. There's no more Mecca there. It's going to be more pop-up universities around the country, right? So Southeastern is a good example of this here in Florida. They have 120 different churches that are their partners now, and they offer courses in those churches across the United States, right? And those churches become the recruiters for them. They build the courses. They work with the churches, and they actually do a little profit sharing around fees that they collect, those kind of things. So for some of our churches that are really struggling, this is a sustainability issue for them. It'll help them, with revenue and some of those kind of things. But it really helps the university, because a place like Warner Pacific, we don't have any brand in Indianapolis. We can't just start selling ourselves there. The cost for getting our name out would be too expensive. But if we have a church that really believes in us, and they talk it up, and they get their parishioners to come in and to take courses, boom, we have enrollment. Now, it all feeds into the online program, so they don't have to have 50 people enrolled. They can have 10 people enrolled, and those 10 people can take classes where 20 are enrolled, and it still works. So some of those kind of new ideas, I know Southern New Hampshire is looking at libraries to do the same thing. How do we do that? We have to think more agilely about the university and get away from, like, the mecca location. And then micro degrees, and I have one more slide and I'll let you go, but micro degrees are really what you see where, not really so much a bachelor's degrees, but at the master's level, if you go in and you're working in a field that has all of a sudden really started to embrace data analytics and systems thinking, those kind of things. You can come and you can take four classes in data analytics, right? And you take those four classes, they're offered by full-time faculty. You do the same type of coursework that you would in a full degree. But at the end of it, you only have to take those four and you get a micro degree in data analytics. You get a micro degree. I think it's going to be a really interesting, because the fact of the matter is the future of master's degrees is going to be interesting to watch, because they don't, it's kind of like, okay, you get an MBA and you have a foundation. But then in 10 years, your MBA is irrelevant, right? The world has changed. But you don't want to come back and do another master's degree, and you don't want a PhD, but you've got to do something. We've got to fill that gap. Micro degrees are one way we can begin to fill that gap. But we also have to understand that Transformation V requires spaces, resources, and attention, okay? You can't do it without that. But what I think is interesting is for most of us, we feel like we don't even have enough resources to get done what we need to do. You look at a place like Point Loma, and they were in that place. They weren't in an enrollment decline, but their president decided that he would get together a group, cross-section group, and they would do a huge analysis of program by program, its effectiveness, cost to the university, those kind of things. And they would come up with a recommendation of things that could be cut from the university. So they did. They cut three academic programs. They cut one student life division, one thing in the student life division, those kind of things. And they created a fund of about $2 million. They didn't designate it right off. They said it was $2 million for new initiatives. And then they spent the next 2 years figuring out what's the best way to use that $2 million to move the institution forward, as opposed to cutting something so you can start something, so it creates that tension right across the board. You create it, you stop it, you trim it. Now, a lot of us have been through lean times, so trimming is a tough thing. We've cut off all the fat. So it's a difficult political equation, but we have to keep doing it. And then the last thing I would say, I want to give you one slide, but it's basically our institutions, and maybe we can only do this in Transformation B, but we've got to get more into an experimentation mindset. We've got to try some things. The way our system is set up right now is that you bring forward a program, you have worked on syllabus, you've worked on learning objectives, you've done all of this to get it just right, the faculty approve it, and then you launch it, okay? And even if it launches and it's not very successful, you're not about to go back through the faculty and run all that through again and all, to change it kind of deal. You just stick with it. The process to launching something is too arduous in our universities, and it kills experimentation because we don't have any processes that allow us to approve some things experimentally. And then if it works, then we go to run it back through the faculty and approve it full time. We're not thinking outside the box enough on our systems that allow for more agility, and so it's a problem. And we've got to make decisions more quickly. Here's what I found when I did my research. There's a lot of new ideas at the lower levels in higher ed. I mean, it is amazing the great ideas that people are sitting on, right? But you talk to them and they say, well, I threw out the idea and the mid-manager killed it, right? Because the mid-managers get to be mid-managers. Because they're good at playing by the rules. They're good at being effective administrators, bureaucrats, right? And so we've got to figure out a system that allows good ideas to emerge from all over the institution, because we're sitting on some gold mines that we don't do. So how campuses are doing this, and then this really is my last one. About 25% of campuses right now employ a chief information officer. And this has really changed in the last 3 years, that you find chief innovation officers. And the reason being, and I'm not saying you need one or you don't, but I'm telling you why they say they do it is because you need one person who this is their focus. Everybody else, the president could be 100% behind innovation, but he or she is out at a different campus dealing with this kind of legal issue, working with the board. You know, for them to be able to have that dog in the bone type of innovation that really moves things forward is very, very difficult. So having a person there that does that type of work is most critical. But I will say this too, though, that what can the board do to really create these kind of things? And I know you've heard some different conversations, but I would say for a person that works in it, the three things are ask us good questions, right? Don't let us live in our assumptions. It's okay to ask. You don't have to get into the weeds, but to really ask, why is it that we do it this way? And does it need to stay that way? And challenging us. Because again, you think, well, I don't know higher education's business. We need people like you guys who don't know our business that'll ask the questions because we can't see it anymore. And then the second thing is, you've got to get a leader that can lead the change. And then as the board, you have to back them. Because here's the reality. If they're doing a deep level change, people are going to be mad, all right? People are going to be calling the board and they're saying, this person is leading us down a path that will take us away from our Christian mission, right? Even though it has nothing to do with your Christian mission, that's how they're going to frame it to you, right? That's how they're going to frame it to their church leaders and those kind of things. So the board has to decide, we're going to allow for failure, right? We're going to allow for experimentation. We're going to do that. And when we get those calls, we're going to listen, but we're going to say, we back the president. Go talk to that person, right? Go deal with it because we're not going to make a change. Once the campus knows you're not making a change, then everything changes for that president in terms of their ability to make difficult change. Now, of course, as board members, you may need to change out a president. There's no doubt about that, right? I mean, so I'm not suggesting this is not. But the president that you have, if they're trying to make change, get ready because you're going to hear the criticism. I mean, it's just every university I've been, that's the way it's happened. And your posture on that criticism makes or breaks the innovation that happens. So best way to predict the future is to create it. So that's our charge. Thank you so much. I kept you a few minutes late, so I want to make sure you get to lunch and get out this beautiful day and all those kind of things. But thanks for your time and appreciate it.